environmental sequence stratigraphy and the new EPA remediation geology paradigm. It's been sponsored by EPA's Technical Support Project, and we're going to be joined by four speakers today. First, we have Rick Kramer, who is a California licensed professional geologist with over 30 years of environmental experience. He holds an MS degree in geology from the University of California, Davis, and a BS in geology from the University of Pacific. Mike Schultz will be joining us as well. He's a senior geologist and stratigrapher with Burns and McDonald in Concord, California. He has over 10 years of experience as a reservoir geologist and over 5 years applying that in the petroleum industry with best practices of facies models and sequence stratigraphy to groundwater remediation. He holds a BS in geology from Purdue University and a PhD in geology from Stanford. Colin Plank will also be joining us. He's a senior stratigrapher and geomorphologist with Burns and McDonald in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He has 15 years of consulting experience, and he essentially is looking at interpretations of geologic sequences preserved in glacial, marine, terrestrial, and freshwater depositional environments to contaminant flow pathways and storage zones. He holds a master's in geology from the University of South Carolina and a BS in geology from Grand Valley State University, Michigan. And we will also be joined by Herb Levine. He is a senior hydrogeologist here at the U.S. EPA Region 9 Superfund Program. Mr. Levine has over 32 years of experience in that capacity, providing in-house consulting to EPA remedial project managers on site investigations and cleanups, as well as regulatory issues. And Herb holds a master's and bachelor's in geology from the University of Illinois. With those introductions to our speakers, I'm actually going to turn things over to Herb here in just a moment, who will be your first official speaker for today's session. Again, questions, comments, use that Q&A window at any time to send them on in. And once we get the materials up on the screen, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Herb Levine to kick off today's session. So Herb, whenever you're ready, please feel free to begin.
All right. Well, thank you, Gina, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. We're very excited to be able to present this new EPA guide on applying sequence stratigraphy to our environmental sites. And let me explain, first what Gene, I can't advance this slide.
Herb, why don't you try the arrows on the bottom of the screen first, and then the keyboard will start working.
All right. There we go. So, our motivation was to look at, why at some of our sites, Superfund sites, why has the remediation efforts not been as successful as originally planned? And are there some, was there some unique characteristics or circumstances that prevent these sites from attaining our cleanup standards? And we recognized, as have many others, that contaminant flux is often just limited to geologically controlled flow zones. And we understand that it's critical to identify where these flow zones or flux zones for contaminants are located. And our goal is to provide both the industry and regulators with an approach for applying geologic principles and methods so that we could locate where these flux zones are. And also, this will help, focus and complement our high-resolution site characterization. Our expectation is that project managers will reconsider their conceptual site models following this new EPA guide. And I'd like to also identify a session that we're hosting at the upcoming Battelle Chlorinated Conference next week. On Wednesday afternoon at 12:30, there's an afternoon session on remediation geology. So we invite you all who are participating at Battelle to come by and see us there. So we want to announce that EPA is committed to applying stratigraphic analysis to our hazardous waste sites. It's our expectation that these methods be considered for each site. The EPA has advocated updating existing conceptual site models when new data are obtained. Many of you are familiar with the life cycle CSM guidance that's available on our CLUIN website that advocates updating conceptual site models. This new EPA guide that we present today utilizes a method that allows you to use the existing site data. So new data are not necessarily required to perform this analysis. And then updating these conceptual site models can occur at any time. It could be a component as part of an ongoing RIFS, or post-ROD as part of an annual groundwater monitoring report that evaluates or discusses new data in light of a conceptual site model, or as we'll see in a case study later on, as part of a five-year review. We recognize that stratigraphic analysis is best conducted by experienced stratigraphers. In the future, EPA will be writing into contracts for fund lead sites, sites that we direct, for conceptual site models to be developed in collaboration with a stratigrapher. And it's also our expectation that work products that include the conceptual site models be checked and by an experienced stratigrapher. And this paper that we're going to talk about today is part of an ongoing EPA geology initiative. We've already completed two of these papers on best practices for environmental site management. Today we'll be discussing a practical guide for applying environmental sequence stratigraphy to best improve conceptual site models. We've already published, and you can find available on the CLUIN website, the contents of a groundwater monitoring report. These other three papers are in preparation now, characterizing groundwater and subsurface and surface water interaction, geology characterization at hazardous waste sites, and best practices for groundwater sampling methods. So publication and training announcements for these papers will be announced on the EPA's TechDirect, as has this paper. In the future, we're hoping to offer a day-long training on environmental sequence stratigraphy, where we can provide a workshop for how to apply these methods at environmental sites. So what are the benefits of applying this environmental stratigraphy, sequence stratigraphy approach? Well, the most notable is that we're able to identify now groundwater flow paths and contaminant migration pathways. We're able to map and predict contaminant transport or mass flux through high permeability zones. And identify the low permeability zones where matrix diffusion-related storage is located. We can identify data gaps and help focus high-resolution site characterization programs. Another benefit is the ability to optimize groundwater monitoring programs, so we target the flux zones and improve the efficiency and optimize our remedies. We think that going forward, applying these methods and techniques will reduce the overall cost of remediation. Now, it's been recognized by others, and we see this often presented in the literature, that upwards of 90% of mass flux contaminant transport at Superfund sites has been shown to be through 10% of aquifer material. So it's essential to develop a conceptual site model that adequately reflects that and identifies where that 10% of aquifer material is that is transmitting the bulk of the mass. We found that site conceptual models that do not consider depositional environments tend to incorrectly interpret the geologic plumbing that, which will lead to, you know, a faulty remedy selection or design, and can also lead to unnecessarily lengthy cleanups. So in the announcement in TechDirect for this webinar, there's also a direct link to the new EPA guide, this groundwater issue paper, this practical guide for applying environmental sequence stratigraphy. And here are the contents of the paper. There's a discussion on the problem of aquifer heterogeneity, a discussion on depositional environments and facies models, along with a method for applying these to our sites. You'll see that there's a discussion on each type of depositional environment, along with a presentation rules of thumb of how to apply these basic principles of sequence stratigraphy to our site data. And then the paper, as well as the talk today, includes case studies. There you go. And today we'll present a case study of a site that was identified through an inconsistency noted in a five-year review for a site down in Silicon Valley out here in Region 9. Right. And so now I'd like to pass this on to Rick Kramer, who will further present the introduction to sequence stratigraphy.
Thank you, Herb. So, yes, and thanks. Herb took us through an outline of the paper, introducing the paper itself. This is an outline of the presentation we're the remainder of the presentation we're going to give today. First, I'll give an overview on what we call this paradigm shift that's focused on geology, and then talk about why ESS is important, addressing the challenge of subsurface heterogeneity, and then go into what it actually is. And with that, I'll hand off to our experts. The stratigrapher, Mike Schultz, will talk about applying rules of thumb, and then Michael present the first case study, and Colin Plank will wrap it up with the Kirtland case study. Okay, so yeah, this focus that Herb referred to on geology, I want to start it off by giving a general definition of geology, the science that deals with Earth's physical structure, substance history, and the processes that act on it. So the focus here is the science of geology is about understanding those processes so with the data that we have, the limited data that we have, we can make interpretations away from our data points. So geology is not the boring log description, the lithology description. That's the geologic data. So the focus here is, again, the science on being able to apply geologic principles to interpret between and beyond the data that we have, with the goal being, in the case of ESS, defining the stratigraphy, the subsurface plumbing, so we could better, for our projects, we could better understand how groundwater moves and where contaminants move through the subsurface. And Herb also brought up the focus on stratigraphy and stratigraphers, the actual practitioners. And an example is the medical field. You get your MD, you get your medical degree, and you get exposed to all these other fields, but then you then do your residency in order to actually, be a certified or licensed expert in any one of these. And it's not unusual, it's not different than geology. Those who aren't familiar with, the discipline science of geology, it's composed of all of these sub-disciplines. And so with your bachelor's in geology, you get exposed to all of these, you get a class or two in all of these, but it's not until you take a graduate course and beyond that you actually become an expert in any one of these. And like I said, like we were talking about, the focus here is on the science of stratigraphy, and that's, again, the reason for this emphasis on the practitioner, and we'll talk about that a little more later. So, focus on geology, but now let's talk about pretty much the way the understanding the subsurface has evolved in our industry and in environmental consulting. And there's been a traditional focus on engineering in that most all of our environmental consulting companies and firms evolved from engineering practices. And that's even shown by what was developed as the standard for defining the subsurface, and that would be, that's been the Unified Soil Classification System, which is not a geologic approach to defining. It's an engineering approach that's focused on material characteristics, even the way subsurface is identified as soil. This is pulled from just a piece from the classification system as an example from ASTM. ASTM guidance on the USCS. So that's one of the strong basis for how we look at the subsurface in our industry. And what I'm showing here now is also how it's evolved to interpret between our data points. I'm going to blow this up a little so we could see it better, but pretty much the standard is to take the USCS classifications and develop what we call strip logs, like we see here, post-strip logs, and then do what's called lithostratigraphic correlations. And that, fairly simply, is just matching up sands to sands and clays to clays. All right. So again, we'll get into this in a little more detail later on, but again, this is more the standard on how, in our industry, we define the subsurface. And another place that discipline that has evolved in understanding the subsurface and particularly how groundwater moves through the subsurface has been through the groundwater production industry, which is generally at a different scale than we look at the subsurface. And from this, in order to get our arms around what's going on and how things are moving and where groundwater flows, the common practice is to identify what we might consider relatively homogeneous layers in the subsurface and then apply Darcy's law, this assumption of homogeneous and isotropic conditions. And the way this is shown is in most of our groundwater reports that you'll see, the primary way we define how groundwater moves is, as you see on the left, first plotting out groundwater head data and contouring that. Well, as we actually draw each of those contours, it's with this underlying assumption of homogeneous and isotropic conditions. And then based on that gradient map, the contour map, we assume a flow direction. And then we carry that through our conceptual site model. What you see on the right is the contaminant plume. The way we best try and define the nature and extent of that plume is to then plot the chemistry concentration data and then contour that with, again, this underlying assumption of groundwater flow. And all this holds up fine as long as the subsurface conditions approach homogeneous and isotropic conditions, right? But if we run into any complexities and heterogeneities, then this assumption falls apart. So that's getting us to the focus of what we're presenting today. And this is, you know, why is environmental sequence stratigraphy important? And it's really in addressing this challenge of subsurface heterogeneity. And with that, take you on a little field trip, give you an example of how the science is applied. And as Herb says, number one, it's a focus on depositional environments. So what you see on the right there is a block diagram that shows various depositional environments, everything from glacial and lake deposition to ocean, offshore marine. What you see circled is a meandering stream deposit, and that's this example we're going to give. I mentioned the importance of the experts of in stratigraphy that train stratigraphers. What they do is they go around the world, basically, evaluating where different depositional systems and the resulting rocks and stratigraphy that's formed, where that crops out in the surface, where it could be studied in three dimensions. This example is an outcrop from Alberta, Canada. It's one of the most visited outcrops in the country there because it's the same formation where hydrocarbons, majority of the hydrocarbons are produced there. And that little red circle you see for scale is a geologist, a stratigrapher who's mapping some of that outcrop. And that's what they do. They study this, geologists study this in three dimensions. So then when they get the limited subsurface data that we have on our projects, they have a basis for being able to understand how these different sand bodies and clay bodies are put together. So we're going to focus on, zoom in on this, and generally speaking, the sediments are deposited from the bottom up. So the light colored that we see there, the light gray is the channel deposits, so that's coarse grain, high permeability, sand and gravel. The darker brown color, those are floodplain deposits, that's fine grain silts and clay. So when we think of it in terms of, you know, groundwater systems, we have our aquifer, sand channels are our aquifers, and the floodplain deposits are our aquitards. But when you look closer at this, particularly at that lower sand body, what you see are these thin clay layers, right? And I'm going to emphasize them with these red lines. In this particular depositional environment, the meandering stream depositional environment, the main sand channels are not, details of how those are deposited are not from the bottom up, but really on this page, but from the left to the right. It's something called lateral accretion. And during the evolution of depositing the sand body, there are periods of low energy when these clay units are deposited. And although they're very thin, they could be quite continuous, on the order of tens of meters to kilometers. So essentially, these end up becoming barriers to groundwater flow in a groundwater system. Okay, and what we're going to do here with this, you know, outcrop is, let's assume that this is one of our sites that's underlain by this depositional system, and that's not uncommon to have any kind of fluvial or groundwater meandering stream depositional environment. But so what I'm showing here is an assumed groundwater table, okay, in blue. And if we're to come upon this project and try and understand and put together our conceptual site model, we would, you know, install our initial wells. Here's three well locations on this cross-section, so to speak, and that are screened, and that when it hits that sand channel, that would be the first saturated sand. And typically speaking, we would hit that first sand, call it the A sand, and assume that it's relatively homogeneous and isotropic, and these three wells are in communication, screened. When in fact, what we see here with these thin clay layers, in reality, the screens in well one are not in communication with two, it's not in communication with three. These clay layers have actually compartmentalized the sand body, and the hydraulic conductivity in and out of this plane of this slide is orders of magnitude higher than from left to right. Okay. So, and this these depositional features in this depositional environment, that is the rule and not the exception. And this is something that a stratigrapher, just knowing what system that is underlying the site, goes in knowing to look for these kind of features and map out this kind of heterogeneity. So that's just an example. We'll show others with case studies of the importance of understanding heterogeneity. And then also just to show very quickly how this could impact the cost and efficiency of a groundwater remediation system. This is one of the sites we worked on where we got brought aboard after they had defined the remediation design, the remedial action plan, and it, we were brought on to do the pilot study. And the original conceptual site model is just as you see here. So the design for this containment system, it was a perchlorate plume that was impacting production wells to the degree that they actually had to do wellhead treatment. Well, they wanted to contain that plume, so the design was to install a series of extraction wells. And this cross-section, again, shows the conceptual site model where the yellow are the sand units and the aquitards are the clay units that are in green. And so it was designed for 125-foot long screens. And then this was an estimate of what that system would cost over a 30-year period for pumping and treating. Well, when we looked at that, and our stratigraphers understood the depositional environment of braided stream fluvial system, right off they said, with this existing data, we could tease out a lot more detail in the stratigraphy. And we convinced the client and the regulators to reevaluate the existing data and develop a more detailed stratigraphic framework for the site before we went out and did the pilot study to actually define continuity of contaminants and the units. And what you see is that as a result of that, the contamination was really just contained in the upper 35 feet of that 125-foot unit. And so that had a significant impact on the design of this cleanup system. It reduced the quantity of extracted groundwater by over 70%, and the overall cost of an estimate of over a 30-year period by over $50 million. So again, point there being is that the geology matters, heterogeneity matters. And in 2013, this report by the National Research Council was published called Alternatives for Managing the Nation's Contaminated Groundwater Sites. And what did some of the results showed that of over 126,000 groundwater impacted sites in the U.S., more than 10% would be considered complex, which generally means that the inherent geologic complexities are such that they would not meet cleanup criteria. So again, this was a big heads up to our industry that geology is impacting our ability to remediate and approach sites. So with that background, I'm going to give an overview of what is environmental sequence stratigraphy. And this science actually emerged out of the petroleum industry. And in the early days, the geologist's job in the petroleum industry was primarily just to find the oil. And the challenge was an engineering challenge on addressing the capacity, what was being brought to the surface. And it wasn't until these oil fields went into decline that the field of petroleum, discipline of petroleum geology evolved. And that's because in order to make these economic, these fields economic, they had to do a better job of managing oil production. And with that, the petroleum industry has invested billions of dollars in research and development on the stratigraphic controls of fluid flow. So, you know, basically their overall goal in understanding the subsurface is the same as ours. And it was in this industry that the science of sequence stratigraphy was developed, and it wasn't until later on, early 2000s, that it actually was published to the public, and now it is the standard for understanding sediments and sedimentary rocks. Now, when it comes to environmental sequence stratigraphy, this is focused on how to apply the understanding of depositional systems and facies models to the kind of data that we collect in our industry. And it generally can be broken down into these three steps. The first is the focus on the depositional system, like I showed in that field trip, understanding the depositional system and how sand bodies, clay bodies are preserved in the subsurface. And then the second part is being able to take our existing data on our sites and format it such that a stratigrapher can make these correlations and predictions between our data points. And then ultimately, it's about mapping out the plumbing in the subsurface, the three-dimensional permeability framework. And our examples will show that. But let me just reemphasize the importance of the practitioner, because it's a lot about pattern recognition. Just like this example with the jigsaw puzzle, if you didn't have the cover that showed this was a sailboat scene, then you'd have a hard time putting any of the pieces together. And that's not unlike any project that we work on. We always have just a limited amount of data where our boring logs are. So what's key is to understand how those sediments in the subsurface are put together. And with a stratigrapher, they have an encyclopedic knowledge of depositional systems and how the related sand bodies and clay bodies are distributed in the subsurface based on these understandings of these different facies models. And here's some examples here: glacial system, alluvial fan, meandering stream, coastal depositional systems. So those are basically the cover of the jigsaw puzzle that stratigraphers start out with before they even start looking at any site-specific subsurface data. Okay, and this is also carried on to the kind of data. This is what evolved with all the studies in the petroleum industry, because similar to us, a lot of times they're limited. Sure, that in some cases they have 3D seismic, but they're really limited to tying their data, ground-truthing it to where there's boring logs, all right? So this is the nexus, the connection between understanding depositional environment and then how that relates to the data, the actual boring data itself. So what you see here on the right is, these different depositional systems in the block diagram, and on the left are these logs in the petroleum industry. They're electric logs or e-logs. But what that shows is vertical grain size patterns with finer grain on the left, coarsest grain on the right. So for instance, for alluvial fan deposits, the major sand bodies that are deposited there have characteristic coarsening up vertical grain size patterns. And for meandering stream fluvial environment, the characteristic major sand bodies are fining upward. For braided fluvials, it's blocky pattern, and this is typical for offshore patterns. So this is key, because this is, again, how we connect the data that we have, our existing data, to the analysis, the ESS analysis. And because typically we have what we need. We have representation of vertical grain size patterns, be it in boring logs, CPT logs, geophysical logs, or even with a lot of the high-resolution site characterization data that we collect. But oftentimes, the frustration of stratigraphers is, all we have are these lousy USCS boring logs, because they're not geologic. And not only that, they're different generations by different geologists, different drilling methods. Okay. Well, what I'm going to show you is this, an important part of the workflow for ESS is taking existing data and creating what we call graphic grain size logs. Okay. And it's really simple. Just like the example of those e-logs that I showed, it's formatting it such that you plot the coarser grain material off to the right, finer grain material like clay closest to the axis. And what you see in this example is on the left is typically it's just the Unified Soil Classification, USGS strip logs. But what you see now superimposed in that is the actual graphic grain size log. And this is what we're able to expose with that is these vertical grain size patterns. And let me show you, how that works as an example. You see in the upper 10 feet, there's a silty sand, SM. And down lower at 30 feet, you see another SM. Well, when you look a little closer and create a GSL, you see that that upper interval was described as a fine to medium grain silty sand, plots out like that, where those green bars are. The lower is fine to coarse grain with gravel, plots out very differently, even though it's the same USCS designation. And this is key because this particular example was from March Air Force Base, which depositional environment is buried river channel deposits. And the finding upward sequences are representative of major channel deposits. And that's what you end up seeing here is that this log actually shows two finding upward sequences, two channel deposits. And this isn't just something that you see here and there. As you can see in this cross-section, the related the logs in the vicinity also show the same pattern, and stratigrapher was actually able to map out the channel deposits. Now, this is important because then from that, we create a network of cross-sections that are interlocking so we could map these features out in three dimensions. And ultimately, this is what is important to a project. This was an impacted zone of about 60 feet, and within that 60 feet, we're able to map out these two channel deposits. And that's what has primary control on groundwater flow and contaminant migration. So this is just to show that it's key to be able to tease out and map out these individual sand bodies, as Herb referred to it, these high flux zones. What you see on the left here is USCS-based cross-sections. So this is taking the same data and just doing a lithographic. In this case it was creek, but generally lithographic correlations. And then on the right, what you see is ESS. And it's only when you can map out these individual units in cross-section that you can show their aerial extent. And it's just not possible to do that using USCS data alone. So with that introduction, now I'm going to hand off to Mike Schultz, and he's going to talk a little more about the nuts and bolts of putting together ESS products.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. Real pleased to be here. I'm going to dive into a little bit more detail here. So first off, Rick gave a bit of an introduction on what we mean when we say environmental sequence stratigraphy. So when we developed ESS, really what we were doing is combining two separate things, related things, sequence stratigraphy, which relates sea level change to stratigraphic architecture, and facies models, such as this one I'm showing here for a prograding barrier shore, which are conceptual and usually presented as a 3D block diagram. But what they do is they bring together observations like from outcrop, from oil fields, from seismic, from modern systems, and they show what the three-dimensional distribution of sand and clay bodies is in the subsurface and relate that to these vertical patterns in grain size, which we call, think of as sort of log signatures that allow us to then predict away from the borehole. So we wanted to come up with some specific suggestions, some things that people could use as a quick check on the site conceptual model. Some of these rules of thumb are more general about the characteristics and the degrees of heterogeneity, like vertical heterogeneity is, in general, an indicator of lateral heterogeneity in fluvial systems, and also help anticipate the need for high-resolution site characterization, what depositional environments require a higher degree of vertical versus lateral resolution in data. And then some of the rules of thumb are sort of more specific, like avoiding two common mistakes in correlation of subsurface data, the first being the what we refer to as the mounded clay, and the second being pillars in cross-sections. So while in my 6 or 7 years now in the industry, after leaving the petroleum industry, I've run across many fine geologists in groundwater remediation. However, there is also a lot of cross-sections that we run across, conceptual site models that look something like this. And this is not, there's no natural system in the world that lays down sediments in this manner. So this is a good example of what we call the pillar facies. And what all this really is an example of where different geologists or different drilling methods, as Rick alluded to, describe the sediments in a slightly different manner, and then somebody essentially blindly went in and put a bunch of Shazams in between different logs. And this is simply reflective of geologic bias in logging, and is not a stratigraphically defensible interpretation, and really does little to plan or implement any sort of remedy. This is fairly common. Now, another common mistake is the mounded clay, and in this example here, we have some CPT logs, pore pressure on the right, and we have three facies. This was an existing conceptual site model, and the yellow being sands, the brown being clays, and the orange being gravel-bearing deposits. And so you know, there's clay in the CPT log here, there's a clay in the CPT log here, there's a clay in the CPT log here. Go ahead and correlate those, which is what had been done historically. And there the whole lore of, well, there's an upper and a lower aquifer, and by God, I'm going to interpret that as such, because that's the way it's always been interpreted. When, in fact, this interpretation is suspect when you look at it in terms of facies models or depositional models for channelized sequences. And we'll take you back to the outcrop here. And what you see in the upper photo is an uninterpreted section where you have a white-colored channel sand body that's incised into the underlying floodplain clays. And then the top of it is essentially rail flat. There's a little bit of perspective from the angle that the photo was taken, but the tops of this channel is rail flat, and that is sort of the rule. Here, I forgot to grab the arrow here, but so this being the base of the channel, and then this being the top of the channel body here. And when you reinterpret just these three logs with that in mind, you get a very different picture of what the stratigraphy here at the site looks like. And instead of drawing this, correlating this clay up and over this mound, well, it's much more reasonable, in fact, to breach that clay. And I will show you a bit more detail on why that interpretation is preferable. So if you look in detail at these CPT logs here, and you look at the pore pressure log, for instance, on the right, there's quite a strong pore pressure response on this side in this clay, and a very, very similar response at exactly the same elevation on the other side of this channel feature. And within the channel, what you see is on the conductivity or the tip resistance log is a very nice finding upward sequence, which is the signature of a channel deposit. And when you combine in the boring log information, you see it has a nice gravel base, such as channels frequently do, a nice finding upward signature here. And in fact, there is no clay. The boring log describes a thin silty zone, which would be consistent with the channel filling sequence. So this interpretation is much more reasonable from a stratigraphic perspective than the mounded clay interpretation that was previously presented. And in fact, groundwater elevation and chemistry data suggest that this is, in fact, the accurate interpretation. So I think, are we going to, with that, come to this Q&A break here?
Okay. Thank you so very much, Mike. We do have a few moments here where we'll pause and take a few questions from the audience. So if you haven't been doing so, I just want to remind everyone there is a Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. You can use that to type in questions or comments for our speakers. And so just click on the empty box all the way at the very bottom. You should be able to type up your message and then hit enter on your keyboard. I'll start with a few of the questions that came in earlier. And Herb, this one was actually directed at you when you started the webinar. You stated that existing data can be used to update the CSM. This participant wants to know if there's any recommendation for how old that data can be. I mean, should you be using data from the last 5 years, 10 years, all of the data with no time frame limitation?
Yes, EPA recommends using all available site data. And we'll go into a detailed example at one of the case studies to show how to utilize existing site data. In this case, it was some of that data was decades old, and reinterpret the site based on a facies model, understanding the depositional environment.
Okay, excellent. This next question asks Rick Kramer. In one of the examples that you gave earlier, it looked like knowledge of structural geologic history, for example, the tilted strata, also influenced the interpretation. Is that correct?
In that case, no, but yes, that's very important to understand the structure as well. The dip that you saw in that example, that's actually depositional dip. Okay, so that was not influenced by tectonics in the future.
I think if that question is referring to the perchlorate example, that is structural deformation around the Japan Gabriel fault.
You're right. I was referring to the field trip that in Canada. But good point, Mike. Yes, the case study example that was and in that case we didn't include that. That's one of the case studies in the paper, so you could actually see and go through the process of how we datumed on an original floodplain clay in doing the correlations, and then after datuming on the clay and doing the interpretation of other floodplain features and then defining sand channels, we then put it back into elevation showing the structural depth. So the case study in the paper goes into more detail on how that was created.
Okay, excellent. We have another question that says, using the graphic grain size logs to define buried channels from your SoCal Air Force Base, there seems to be a lot of extrapolation from an ESS-based cross-section using those grain size logs. They want to know, did you use any other data to construct your ESS-based cross-section?
In that case and in most of the cases, no. The focus is, and the data that primary data that we use is grain size data, whether it be from the boring logs and any other. There was, in that case, there were also some CPT logs. So really, any of the data that we collect that represents vertical grain size patterns is incorporated into the evaluation. But let me say that's the geologic evaluation, and that's the initial, putting the stratigraphic framework together is the initial step. Then we bring in the other data sets, the chemistry data, the groundwater head data, because, you know, generally speaking, the geology data is our data set that's static, okay? Our other data sets, they're are dynamic. They change with different conditions. As, you know, groundwater elevation and groundwater levels change, chemistry changes throughout. So the focus is first on the geology and the stratigraphy, like what we say is basically define the plumbing. And then on within that framework, we do, like Mike showed in his case study, his example, where initially he identified that clay being eroded by the channel purely with the lithology, the geologic data. And then he looked at other data sets, including chemistry data, to actually validate or to make better interpretations with multiple lines of evidence.
All right, excellent. I think just in the interest of time, we'll probably carry on with the presentation, but we will pause again at the end of today's session for another Q&A break. So I encourage the participants to continue to type those questions in, and we will pause again. So I think we're resuming on this Q&A slide with you, Mike. Feel free to carry on.
Thanks, Jean. Okay, so one of the case studies in the paper is about something near and dear to us in the Bay Area. That's Silicon Valley. It's a former semiconductor manufacturing site with VOCs and other contaminants. And, of course, it's a dense urban area with multiple sources and commingled plume. So our particular site that we're going to look at is less than 10 acres, and we're dealing with about 100 feet of stratigraphy here. In terms of the geologic setting, these are channel deposits, channels that were sediments shed off of the Santa Cruz Mountains and draining into San Francisco Bay. And we used a set of boring logs that were at least 20 years old to reinterpret the stratigraphy in here. And this occurred in response to a five-year review where a decision was made to take a deeper dive into the stratigraphy to look at potential migration, contaminant migration pathways from off-site sources. So here's sort of the two facies original conceptual site model. And so what historically with this plume had been managed or understood via a depth-based zonation of the stratigraphy that was used to contour groundwater levels and also plumes. And this results in a somewhat simplified view of the subsurface with the plume geometry, as you're seeing here in the blue. So the blue edge is a 5 microgram per liter contour, and then the darker blue is 100, and then the dark blue is 1,000. And so what's really going on in this plume is that different screens are intercepting different channels at depth, some of which are higher concentration than the other. And so when it's contoured together, what you see are these bullseyes, which reflect simply screens that penetrate other zones. And also, this lumping or depth-based zonation leads to the groundwater contours, which are shown on here, being relatively poor predictors of contaminant transport directions. So So the red box here shows generally the site that, or the portion of the plume that we were focused on, and the source area was right here in white, and then directly, quote unquote, down gradient, judging by groundwater, the way that this plume map was contoured, were some wells that had some increasing concentrations, and in the 5-year review, it was presumed that these groundwater contours were, in fact, predictors of contaminant transport direction, but they're not. Groundwater is sort of like electricity, if for another analogy, in that it essentially takes the path of least resistance to get from regionally up gradient to regionally down gradient. But it can go around corners, essentially. It can even go upstream locally in extreme cases. So I'll show you how we were able, with the existing vintage boring logs on the site, to elucidate the pathways of contaminant transport, and in fact show that these increasing concentrations here were related to a separate, distinct off-site source. And probably resulted in the ability to not undertake costly remediation that probably would not have been effective at reducing concentrations in these wells. Okay, and so we've talked about these graphic grain size logs, and what I'm showing you over here is a piece of one of these historic logs, and I don't know if you can read this, but this red box on the far right, this is our graphic grain size log for this well, with the coarser grained materials here, the gravel bearing sands in orange and red, and the silty sands in greens, and the clays here in blues close to the axis. And this piece of the grain size log corresponds to this part of the boring log here. And so at the base of the sand, there's up to gravel of an inch in diameter, and in a sandy gravel, and moving upwards vertically, even the grain size of the gravel decreases systematically to a half inch here. In this sense, you move from sandy gravel upwards into silty sand, and then from there into a sandy silt and a silty clay. So you have, at this site, there are very clear sort of classic migrating or point bar type sinuous channel signatures, which then instead of using presence or absence of sand, you begin to map these channels around on the basis of this log signature. And so these grain size logs are assembled into, you know, any orientation of cross section desired to look at down gradient transport or cross gradient transport. In this case, we're looking cross gradient. And if we think back to one of the rules of thumb, that is that the bases of channels, so in the cross-section interpretation that I'm showing on the bottom here. So the bases of fluvial channels tend to be highly erosive in nature and have a lot of topography on them, but the tops of them tend to be rail flat. So that helped it to interpret the stratigraphic architecture in cross-section. And then two channel bodies that are they're only several feet thick that I'll point out here, HSU-1, Hydrostratigraphic Unit 1, and Hydrostratigraphic Unit 2 were mapped around the site in detail. And Hydrostratigraphic Unit 2 maps this body here, maps in this orientation, connecting an off-site source with the wells with increasing concentration. Whereas Hydrostratigraphic Unit 1, which was located near the area of former remediation activities in the on-site source area, maps out with a significantly different orientation. And so what then we did as a check on this interpretation was we generated these bar charts, which are simply log plots of a different suites of different contaminants. I think that it's clear on the next slide. Yeah, okay. Thank you. So we've got PCE, TCE, CIS-12DC, vinyl chloride, and Freon, which is somewhat unique to this site, but it turns out that Freon was not used in the on-site processes, but was off-site. And so when we look at this HSU-2, which maps off to off-site sources, then all of the wells that are uniquely screened within that unit all show Freon. This one historically had Freon, just not in the period that we're plotting here. Whereas the on-site channel, due to the remediation activities that had been carried out, contains significant quantities of vinyl chloride here in the yellow. So the one well then, with increasing concentrations, intercepts the screen within that well intersects both the on-site and off-site channel, and then as a result contains the whole mixture of the different contaminants, providing a separate multiple line of evidence that in fact this is the architecture of these channels at this site. Okay, and as another follow-on to this work, there was a focused high-resolution site characterization program carried out, also in the interest of validating this CSM, but also identifying additional channels carrying contamination on site. And I'm showing you this because it's quite striking here. So what we're looking at is conductivity logs, and then I think XSD logs from a MIP here. And so what's very clear are these fining upward cycles representative of these slightly sinuous channel bodies in the subsurface. And at depth, that's where the contamination is moving. So very discrete, thin zones of groundwater flow and contaminant transport are moving the vast majority of the mass, as Herb alluded to early in the presentation. So what we show is that, you know, to wrap it up here with regard to this case study is that in heterogeneous, especially fluvial deposits, you need to be very careful in what you choose to lump together when making groundwater contour maps, because oftentimes it's highly dependent on what the screen is intercepting, and groundwater flow can deviate significantly from regional groundwater gradient. So this changed the trajectory of the project, led to resolution of the five-year review issue, and going forward will change monitoring objectives and result in a more holistic view of this very large, high-profile, commingled view that will bring the parties together to the table and hopefully lead to a more efficient closure or management process for this plume. And with that, thank everybody, and I will turn it over to my colleague, Colin Plank, who will walk us through sort of a slightly much larger scale problem at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mike. hopefully everyone can hear me and the sound quality is okay. So this is a case study that we'll just hit on briefly in the time remaining. It's not included in the EPA paper, but we wanted to talk about it here because it illustrated the impact of the ESS approach in development of a CSM that united stakeholders at a complex problem and also addressed a much larger scale site. So just as geology can be observed at a myriad of scales down from, you know, the outcrop and local gas station scale up to, you know, regional studies, you know, these methods are applicable at a wide range of scales. So here we were dealing with a plume scale on the order of, you know, 7,000 or over a mile long, half mile wide, water tables at depths of 500 feet down below ground surface and borings of, you know, over 1,000 foot depth. And when we were brought in to this project, it was a time in which there was a lot of conflict. The Air Force and the regulatory agencies were at odds with one another, and this was stemming largely from communication issues, not communicating effectively, you know, hypotheses that were being pursued, not illustrating concepts of, you know, sort of the roadmap forward. Limited exchange of information was occurring between the groups, partly because of this sort of deteriorating relationship. And overall, from the technical team's perspective, this just resulted in the snowballing effect of ineffective integration of data. And so, you know, no one was leveraging the data they were collecting to move the project forward, let alone move it forward efficiently. And so in the midst of this, you know, political and public organizational groups began to get a hold of the ethyl dibromine leak issue occurring up the base, and public attention was brought to bear. And so with this dysfunction occurring, you know, the public perception was largely that little was being done to solve their problem. And so it was a very high-pressure time. And this is an example of some of the CSM related work that existed at this time, and this is one of their traditional cross sections, and it's a perfect example of the fact that a cross section is not just an opportunity to post the geologic data collected. This is it's a communications tool and a linchpin sort of tool for your technical team to begin hanging all other data on top of, and if your cross-sections look like this, then you're missing a golden opportunity on a lot of levels. So a section such as this that has the traditional USCIS logs, and I realize they're very tiny here because this is a very large-scale section, and some of the geophysical data that they had collected, these are resistivity logs, they really only went in and put in maybe one stratigraphic boundary between alluvial deposits and ancestral Rio Grande deposits. And it played into, you know, some of the perceptions that, or some of the assumptions that, you know, homogeneity rules, right? I mean, there's no visual indicator of the complexity of the subsurface on here. And so this, again, feeds into that snowballing effect of, you know, the public perception. If this is simply a sandbox through which the contaminant and groundwater is moving, how come you can't give me a final answer as to whether or not my well is going to be impacted? So to everybody's credit, you know, they realized that the things were getting out of hand, and they took this as an opportunity to reboot stand up technical working groups, both modeling, hydrostratigraphic groups, remediation-focused groups. And really, this is what we took the most pride in, and I hope to show, is that what the ESS approach helped do was start to build a CSM which refocused all of these disparate groups on the common enemy, and that is, you know, the uncertainty created by subsurface heterogeneity. So I'm just going to step through, you know, we came in and started applying the process, the three steps that Rick went over earlier. And the first sort of step is identifying an effective depositional model, right? Finding what is going to be your box top that you're going to try to fit the puzzle pieces around to build. And to do that, we made use of local expert resources at the University of New Mexico, New Mexico State, the Bureau of Mines, did some basic research and came up with, you know, kind of a block diagram type model like Mike was showing earlier, a facies model that showed, you know, the Sandia Mountains to the east of the site serving as a source for alluvial fans, and then this sediment being distributed down the Rio Grande Rift Basin by the ancestral and current Rio Grande River system, a distributive fluvial system here, so braided river. And so, you know, alluvial fans and braided river system with facies that were facies within them that were had, you know, included both permeable zones and impermeable zones, right? So incipient sort of overbank deposits, incipient floodplain would be the impermeable zone within the braided fluvial. The channel fills and braided bar complexes would be the permeable zones within the braided fluvial. And then the distributary channels would be the zones of transport within the alluvium, and the interdistributary zones within the alluvial fans would be the fine-grained zones. And we related that then to, you know, the outcrop exposures of these materials that we could use to illustrate very clearly, you know, the gravel-rich permeable zones within braided fluvial deposits, the silty to clayey interdistributary zones, and then also, you know, did the same in the alluvial fan. And so this, again, speaks to this idea of when at all possible, get to an outcrop, get to an exposure. In this case, we're actually able to access gullies and so on that really actually gave us windows to what was directly underlying the base. Get to an outcrop or an exposure because this is the highest resolution characterization of the subsurface you're going to get, right? It's all downhill from there. And then also, you know, with the analog and the building of the depositional model, you know, you can begin to use that as a communication tool. Here we've taken the plume outline and placed it into the scale of a braided fluvial system to try to relate to technical team and the public the concept that these permeable zones with the lighter grays, these gravel-rich and sand zones, would be these bar complexes that would have a trend that would sort of flow within the active channel belt of the braided system. And then there would be silty zones shown in the grays here and abandoned large portions of the belt that would be the aquitards. So we could begin to put this plume in the context of depositional the depositional story that we're building. And again, building on this even further at a local scale with some of the quaternary or surface geology maps, here are the permeable zones within Rio Grande deposits are being shown in the outline in red, and the plume geometry is being related to that scale. And this begins to kind of build the depositional story, right? So then, you know, we began actually tackling the data on hand. And one of the issues that was giving people headaches was this apparent disagreement between the logs, the lithologic observations from the drilling, and the resistivity logs being collected. Where there were resistivity lows, they were not seeing grain size trends they were expecting to see in the borings. And so we examined, you know, they're doing a great job retaining cuttings, which is not always done, but this was available for observation later. And we determined that because of the air rotary method being used, two things were happening. The fines were being obliterated and were biasing the lithologic logs to a coarser grain size. And then also one of the key indicators of fluvial versus alluvial fan deposits was the degree of roundness and the maturity of the gravel component of the sediments, and that air rotary system was resulting in just obliterated gravels, so everything looked angular, even though you could clearly see when looking at the cuttings, you know, weathered, rounded surfaces and then freshly broken angular surfaces. So we suggested a continuous sonic approach and some core collection, and then also went back and began reformatting the logs in terms of our graphic grain size logs, as shown here. And that is a really useful exercise because you're basically formatting this record to mimic some of the same continuous data that you might be collecting downhole, you know, CPT logs. In this case, this is a resistivity log. And this shows that the silty zones that are present as part of a fining upward fluvial package, this is these are 5 foot nick ticks here, so about a 20 foot thick channel fill. It's actually in pretty good agreement with the resistivity data shown. And so this pointing to the sources of data as being in disagreement with one another, that was kind of a point of contention among the technical team, you know, some wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater and so on. We were able to alleviate a lot of that and bring all the data together and start integrating it. Once we did that, we began developing cross-sections at a series of different scales. And I'm going to just blow through these quickly here. But this, you know, we advocate working from a regional scale down to a plume scale down to a remediation scale, right, sort of honing in on the details of the site as need be. And so this would be a regional section which would have cross-cut our depositional model like so, perpendicular to the depositional axis of the Rio Grande. And we identified within here, instead of just a two-phase sort of model, we have our proximal alluvial fan, distal or finer-grained alluvial fan, then the axial fluvial permeable zones within the ancestral Rio, and then the incipient floodplain and or fine-grained zones. And there's probably a larger climate sort of signal driving some of that. And so in doing this, we were able to pick out, map a deeper regional aquitard, put the plume in scale, in sort of in perspective of the overall geology. Here's the plume, the main contaminant mass, the EDB plume, moving in and out of this plane here. And so this is, I should point out here, the scale, this is about a mile here, right? So these are 1,000-foot borings, mile long, multiple mile long stratigraphy. Then honed in on that, and now I'm actually looking at a cross-section that cut down the center of the plume. The plume's not shown on this, but it would have been right down the center of the ancestral Rio. And so here we can see now we're cross-cutting the distributary channel axes. So these pathways would have been in and out of the plane here, whereas we're moving parallel to, there's a small amount of structural dip on the ancestral Rio deposits here, moving parallel to these sandy zones within the braided river and these sort of less continuous to slightly continuous overbank deposits. So what this did is it started to better define the complexity of the pathways and better one of the concerns at the site was kind of developing an understanding of this 450-foot clay, right? This is another one of these sites that had sort of built-in infrastructure that there is a 450-foot clay. And so as you can see, there's lots of 450-foot silty clays, and they make a roughly continuous basal zone that would hold up a plume, but there's greater complexity than that. And so this started to provide a roadmap to actually understand that better. And so they used this to begin to understand the control on the base of the EDB plume, to begin also to understand one of the problems, unique problems here, was that groundwater tables are rising as production has decreased. And so this thing is actually going to have a reverse trajectory up through the stratigraphic column now as that groundwater re-equilibrates. They can use this to understand both the current and future trajectory of their contaminant plume. And again, not to put too fine a point on it, but the CSM and developing it and making it a communications tool, both through identifying appropriate outcrop exposures, presenting it in poster forms and in public forums, and then leading field trips to hone that in, to hone the public's perception of that in, really got everyone back on the same page. The public saw the complexity of the problem. They understood the complicated nature of what it was that the regulatory agencies, the responsible parties, and all their respective consultants were dealing with. And really, you know, that's what people want to see. They want to see a communication of the complexity, not just a blank cross-section that says, well, it's kind of a pile of sand and we're working on it, and it's very, very complicated. So this is kind of the kumbaya moment from that project. This is a mix of various contractors, myself included, local experts, the Air Force, the regulatory agency. Here we all are at an outcrop. We've all kind of come back to united behind science to get at the real problem, which is the subsurface heterogeneity. And this is well received. It doesn't go unnoticed, and we received a commendation from the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for this work at Kirtland in kind of righting the ship, getting everyone on the same page. So with that, I'm going to end. Look for us again at Battelle. We're going to be giving a couple of learning labs, and again the session that Rick and Herb talked about. Where this is going in the future is, collecting new data to better facilitate depositional model development in addition to your old data. But let's start doing things a little differently from the get-go when we can to facilitate development of depositional models. And with that, I will turn it back over to I think Gene and the others.
Yeah. Gene, this is Rick. If you could just go to the next slide, the last slide, so we can get to questions. So yeah, this is just a summary slide. We just go through that the benefits of environmental sequence stratigraphy. First, to reduce the uncertainty, identify groundwater flow paths, being able to predict the flux zones, the stratigraphic flux zones, and also help with identifying data gaps. So then if more data is needed, it could be a more focused and cost-effective program. And it's really important for optimizing groundwater monitoring programs, and then just improving the efficiency, effectiveness of groundwater remediation in general and reducing costs. And now I think we're available for questions. Still have a little time for questions.
Okay, excellent. So I'll just go through a few questions here with the time that we have remaining. And I'm going to summarize a few of them just because there seem to be some common themes. So a number of people have asked about the applicability to this method based off of site scale. So there were concerns about whether or not you should be using this technique at a very large site. Could you do this at a very small site? Is there any issue with site scale or size when applying this sequence stratigraphy?
So we purposefully presented two case studies at different scales to illustrate that these methods and techniques are applicable at small-scale sites as well as large-scale sites. Often what we see in groundwater monitoring reports or remedial investigation reports is discussion of the regional geology where people tend to do a pretty good job of going to the literature and looking at what the regional geology is, but then just not carrying that through when interpreting the unique site-specific data within that context of the regional geology.
And just one other quick comment about that is geology in general, the science and the application is very scalable. So I mean, even to the order of the microscopic scale. So yes, of course you're limited by the data that you've collected and the resolution of the data that you have, but yeah, scale is not an issue.
Okay, excellent. I had a couple people ask if I could get myself louder, so I've made my volume a little bit louder. Hopefully that helps. We had a few people asking about specific geologic situations. So they want to know if it's applicable in different types of strata, in different types of subsurface aquifer conditions. So are there any physical scenarios or geologic conditions when this method wouldn't work?
Well, yeah, generally speaking, yeah, it's applicable to what's called clastic sedimentary aquifers or deposits, okay? And generally speaking, that means anytime you're talking about sands, clays, gravels, silts, those are clastic sedimentary depositional systems. So, for instance, it's not applicable if you have a crystalline bedrock fracture system, then no. However, if you have a fracture system and the fractured rock is sedimentary, then yes, this is applicable because fracture patterns are often dictated by the rock unit. But
we should add a little point to that, and that it's not strictly true that it's just clastic. Sedimentary is really the key thing, right? Because you could have carbonate-rich, lime. This is perfectly applicable in limestone bedrock, although, as Rick was saying, with the crystalline bedrock, that fractures might be an issue. In limestone, you'd have an overprint of the secondary porosity. That would be something to definitely consider. But carbonates are just as subject to the depositional model and understanding of the physical nature of the system as clastics.
Okay.
And, one more fine point on there is that flood basalts have a stratigraphy as well that greatly impacts the hydrogeology. So that's a volcanic system where this stratigraphy is critical.
Okay. All right, I'm going to take one last question, and then we'll walk through some closeout reminders. I will point to those of you who perhaps have follow-on questions or comments. Contact information is shown here on the closing slide. We also have it on the seminar homepage. So again, if you have follow-on questions or comments, their information is listed right here. And let's get into this last sort of category of questions. And a number of participants have hit on the variability in interpretation of logs or variability in some of the types of testing that you could be doing, such as CPT. And they just want to know, how are you dealing with or are you seeing a degree of variability in the analysis and logs and results that it's impacting what you're doing, or is that variability manageable such that you can take the data set and still apply it to this method?
I'll start and then I'll hand off to a stratigrapher, but generally speaking, the answer to that is the focus of the stratigrapher is understanding the change in energy of the depositional system, which is represented by maximum grain size. So and what we're looking at is vertical, the relative change in and distribution vertically in grain size, okay? And that is something that no matter who, you know, how many different geologists have contributed to the data that you have, that each one does an adequate job at any one location of defining vertical grain size distribution, okay? What I mean by that is there may be some challenge of what the absolute grain size is, but again, basically identifying these trends, these vertical grain size trends, that's what we found throughout the hundreds of sites that we've worked with is that data set is reliable, okay? Even though there's there could be different drilling methods, different sampling methods, any one site, any one location, you usually have reliable relative grain size information. Mike, do you have anything to
that? Quickly, I would repeat that while one geologist may have described a silty sand and another may have described a sandy silt in the same interval, that what we're looking at are trends, both vertically and laterally, that we can interpret. And just to repeat, these are integrated projects and need to include any direct push data and give that our high-resolution data, logs, and integrate that with the ground truth from the material actual description of the subsurface, and then it's all got to make sense with the hydrogeology and the chemistry data. So certainly integrated projects, every data set has its limitations, and you need to explicitly recognize those and give the appropriate weight to what you think is more representative than the most representative data set that you can use to make the best interpretation.
Okay. Well, with that, I think just in the interest of time, we'll probably go ahead and close things out since we have reached several minutes past our scheduled end time. And I'm going to walk everyone through just a few final reminders before we close out. First of all, I want to thank the over 540 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live broadcast, and I also want to thank our presenters and organizers who helped take time out of their days to present today's content. Before we close out, let me hit on a few common questions that we get. First, a number of you have asked if there are copies of the presentation content available. Yes, the slides are available as a PDF that you can download from the seminar links or resource page, along with a link to the paper that was discussed at the start of today's presentation. So you can follow the links to our seminar resources or links pages I've included. It's on the middle right under related URLs. You'll also see it in the Q&A window. If you happen to be replaying the recorded version, you can still access the materials through those links. As noted, contact information for our presenters and organizers is found in their presentation content, but also on the seminar homepage. And I would ask if each of you could take just a moment to fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content and the method that we used to host our session. One of the most common questions I get is if there are certificates for joining us. While we do not issue PDHs or CEUs, so many times people are able to document their participation and still get credit for the training hours with their own institutions. When you fill out our online feedback form, there is a box you can check at the bottom that certifies you were here for the entire session. You can do this if you were here live, or you can click it if you replayed the entire archive. As long as you check that box and fill out the feedback form correctly, you'll immediately have access to a seminar participation certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. If for some reason you don't see that, you can always fill the feedback form box out again, check the box, and again, that should generate one of those certificates. If you happen to participate in a group, each one of you can follow the link to the seminar feedback form and fill out the feedback form on your own to get your own certificate, even though you may have joined under someone else's registration. As noted earlier, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically receive a link to replay today's session, and you're welcome to forward that on to other colleagues if you think it will be a valuable expenditure of your time. So again, thank you to all of you who joined us for today's session, and to our presenters and organizers for helping to host today's broadcast. This will be the formal